We'll just jump right in. So we're looking at two different variations of time-space sampling that we used to recruit for a NIDA-funded study. And the NIDA-funded study was called the Club Drugs and Health Project, or the PARTY Project, which was an acronym for the Prevention Assessment for Risk-Taking Youth. And it was a study of club-going, drug-using young adults. And we wanted to enroll 400 club-going, drug-using young adults into our study, and we decided we were going to use time-space sampling to do it. Time-space sampling, I'll get into in a second, is usually used just to do like a really, you know, sort of brief survey method or just capture people in the field to get a prevalence. It's not as often used to recruit people into longitudinal, longer-term studies, so that was something innovative that we did. And in this study, the Club Drugs and Health Project, we wanted to enroll 100 gay and bisexual men, 100 lesbian and bisexual women, 100 heterosexual men, and 100 heterosexual women. So those were our goals that we wanted to reach using time-space sampling. And basically, we spent 2 years doing recruitment, and after about 8 months, we realized that the first way that we were doing it wasn't working out so well, so we made an adjustment to it. And then after the fact, said, gosh, we should probably see if this adjustment, you know, systematically biased the sample that we got. So that's what this paper is. Club drugs, for those of you that don't know, ketamine, ecstasy, GHB, cocaine, crystal meth, and we threw in acid into the mix. So we've got 6 different drugs that we were looking at, and club drugs get their name specifically because they've been linked to club culture. So sometimes a lot of our samples, as the first presenter talked about, you know, they're either convenience samples, which limit our generalizability, or if you get, you know, some of the larger studies that we have on club drug use or, you know, probability samples of people that were called on the phone, but then when you're assessing club drug use, you know, with a sample of people over the phone, then you're not really capturing the cultural aspects of club drug use. So we still wanted to look at club drug use in clubs. So time-space sampling was, you know, really pioneered by the Centers for Disease Control with some of their studies, and it was used very often to find location-based populations. And when the CDC used it, they were looking for gay and bisexual men that go to bars and clubs and whatever else. They were considered a hidden population, but we know we can go to bars and clubs and find them there. And the, you know, the really great thing about time-space sampling, and you can argue with me about this, and I'll argue with you too, is that it's a probability-based method. So the assumption being, if you know where your population gathers, you can randomly pick the times to go to that location and whatever else, and in the end, you might actually have a probability-based sample of your population. So that's why we said we were going to use it. Now, with time-space sampling, you have sort of multiple tiers of randomization. You can randomize the day or the time that you're going there, so Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, early, late in the afternoon. You can also randomize the space that you're going to, the assumption being that your research team can't be in all spaces at the same time, so what do? You randomly pick the times and spaces you're going to go to your places. And I've got question marks against the third one, which is individuals within venues. So once you've randomized time and you've randomized space and you get out there, is it necessary to also then randomize individuals, being that approaching every sixth person, approaching every fourth person, or whatever you're doing? And this is where we did this modification. We stopped randomizing at the individual level. And time-space sampling can be very costly, and I've got a little, you know, sort of example here. Like, we go out to a nightclub that was randomly selected, and we go during the time that it was selected, and let's just say that 700 people were coming to this nightclub tonight, and we decided we were going to approach every seventh person, which means, you know, theoretically we might capture 100 people going into the nightclub, being that we live in New York City, lots of people don't like to talk to other people, so we'll say maybe only 58 of them actually said, sure, I'll take your little survey, and of those 58 people, of course, not everyone's a club drug-using young adult, so only 6 of them might be eligible for what you're, you know, really interested in seeking them out for. And of the 6 that are eligible, how many people want to enroll in a longitudinal study while going into a club? So you might actually only get, you know, 2 people. So you went out, you've got hundreds of people there, but you really come out with very little in the end. So we wanted to find a way to sort of improve this. Now, I had question marks under, is it necessary to count at the individual level? And this is how time-space sampling has been described by other researchers. McKelleher and colleagues said they counted all participants who had, you know, entered the venue or whatever they were using it for. They didn't specify what they did with that number, though. Did they count? I hope McKellar's not here. You know, counted all participants, but did they randomize? You know, what do they mean they counted all? Muhib said that they systematically approached, but systematic could be approaching every seventh person, or it could be you systematically approached every person. It's a little unclear about what that means. Fernandez said that they counted every nth person. So in the literature, when you're looking at time-space space sampling, you see some sort of variation in how people are doing it. They do randomize time and they do randomize space, but are they randomizing at the individual level? And so we have to ask ourselves, why would it be necessary to randomize at the individual level? Well, the assumption is that if you don't randomize individuals, that your research team might systematically bias the sample. I only want to talk to people that look like me, or that person looks scary, I don't want to talk to them, compared to, okay, that's the seventh person, you must go approach them. So our data suggests that it doesn't matter whether you count or not, but you can argue with me about it. The first version of time-space sampling, we did it for the first about 7-8 months of the project, which was December 2004 to July 2005. We randomized day, we randomized venue, and we randomized persons going within venues. We went out to bars and clubs in New York City. We had what we would call an exhaustive list of bars and clubs in New York City, Thursdays, Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. We used Palm Pilots to administer a really brief 2-minute survey that was going to capture if people were eligible for our larger study. And we had teams of 3 go out. So there'd be 1 counter and 2 screeners. And the counter's job was to count every 7th person. And they would tell the screener, there's number 7, go screen them. There's number 7, go screen them. So you got a very sort of staff-intensive approach. After about 8 months of doing that, we said, you know what, let's get rid of the role of the counter and let's just approach everyone and anyone that's crossing, you know, the threshold, be it the entrance to the venue. So we had 2 levels of randomization. We still randomized time. We randomized space. We did this for the rest of the duration of the project, and we eliminated a 3rd person from our... We didn't eliminate them, we just moved them somewhere else. So we had teams of 2 rather than teams of 3. Everything was identical otherwise. When we went out in the field, 2-minute survey, you know, what is your gender, what is your sexual orientation, and we just coded it as basically it was straight or other than straight. You know, do you identify as, you know, straight, gay, lesbian, bisexual, queer, and we just, you know, checked off other than straight. Race or ethnicity, and I think we had 6 different categories that we were, you know, checking off as people filled into those, and if you'd ever used a drug. If you had ever used a drug, then the Palm Pilots would skip into certain questions. Have you ever used ketamine, ecstasy, GHB, cocaine, crystal meth, acid? And if you have used any of those drugs, we asked you, how many times have you used in the last year? And if you've used more than 3 times in the last year, the Palm Pilot would prompt you to ask, have you used in the last 3 months? We're only going to look at the data from 18 to 29-year-olds because that was what the larger study was looking at. We wanted to look at young adults and club drug use. Over the course of the 2 years of recruiting for this study, we approached 18,000 people and change, 4,000 during the first version and 14,000 during the second version. Of that, 58% consented. So we have data on 10,000 people that said, sure, I'll do your survey. Our response rate, and this is our first indicator that not counting at the individual level might be better, was significantly better during the second time period. 46% of people said, sure, I'll take your survey when we were randomizing, and that jumped up to 62% when we stopped randomizing at the individual level. I'll visit why we think that is at the end of the presentation. Here's just the breakdown of how the sample looked in terms of the number of gay, bisexual men, lesbian, bisexual women, etc. The analyses that we conducted was within gender and sexual orientation. So we looked at the gay bi men from time 1 to the gay bi men from time 2, the heterosexual men from time 1, the heterosexual men from time 2. Did the participants that we screened, you know, for time 1 look different from the participants that we screened from time 2? And because we ran a bazillion tests, we're going to raise our p-value level to 0.01 to avoid a type 1 error. I think that's what it's called. But on the chart that I've given you guys, I've included the 0.05 stuff just so you have it, so you can't say I'm masking my data or whatever, and you can tell me whether you think this is significant or not. But I'm only going to look at 0.01 or greater. Nobody can read this. It's way too early to read this anyway. But that's table 1 that's included with the handout that I've given you guys. And what's highlighted in yellow is what was significant from time 1 to time 2. So here at the top, I do have. So this is the gay bisexual men, lesbian bisexual women, heterosexual men, heterosexual women. Time 1, time 2, time 1, time 2, time 1, time 2, time 1, time 2. You got all that? And what we see, for instance, with the gay bisexual men, the lesbian bisexual women, straight men, the straight women, there was no significant differences in terms of race and ethnicity from time 1 to time 2. So we didn't bias our sample racially or ethnically. The men from time 2, regardless of sexual orientation, were younger. We don't really know why. What's more important I'm showing here is actually the lack of significant differences. We assessed 6 different drugs, 4 different sexual orientations, that's 24 different combinations, and we really only had you know, three different things in terms of drugs come up. I'm going to skip through this. It's just repeating what I've just said. You have it all in front of you as well. But the take-home point from this is that, you know, of all the different things that we've assessed, very few came up significant in terms of differences from time one to time two. And for whatever reason, it really only happened among the heterosexuals. Heterosexual women less likely to report drug use during time two, but nothing with the other groups going on. When we look specifically among those having tried a drug, no differences in drug use, gay, bisexual men, lesbian, bisexual women from time one to time two. With heterosexual men, we saw a difference in ketamine and LSD. With heterosexual women, we saw meth use, and they were declines from time one to time two. But the other drugs that we assessed, no differences, time one, time two. I'll skip this as well. This is the other table, which is you have in front of you. Again, it's just this is sort of among the subsample. I know you can't read it, but it's in the table in front of you. Looking at among people that are frequent drug users, these are basically the people that would have met criteria for our larger study. And again, the only thing that's really different from time one to time two, or rather there was only one thing different from time one to time two, and that was among heterosexual women. A lot of them that had reported drug use in the past, as far as recent use was concerned, heterosexual women were more likely to endorse that they had not used substances recently. So again, the take-home point from this is that there really weren't a lot of changes from time one to time two, and I welcome dialogue outside of this because I don't want to just sit here and go through every single number. Among the people that were frequent, you know, sort of substance users, the people that would have met criteria for our study, in terms of the Caucasian to person of color ratio, so the number of whites to sort of non-whites, again, no significant differences from time one to time two for any of the four groups that we were looking at. So let's back up a little bit, and you know, I haven't shown that research here, but if you read the research on time-space sampling, some of the people that write about it have said, you know, is this really a feasible method in terms of a way to attract people into your study? Our target, we wanted 400 people in our study, and we approached 18,000 in order to get that 400. We argued that, you know what, if we still randomize time, if we still randomize space, and we stop randomizing at the individual level, we might be able to, you know, make this a more cost-feasible approach. And was it for us? We would say yes. Our response rate improved dramatically. And we thought that it was a better use of our staff time because we were able to, instead of having teams of three, you have teams of two, which is a 50% reduction in staff as far as for what you're paying people. But will this bias the sample was the question of this study. In our data, we say we don't think so. So why did we have differences from time one to time two? In terms of response rate, the sort of feedback we got in the field when we'd walk up to someone going into a club, you know, hi, you've been randomly selected to participate in a two-minute survey. Can I have a moment of your time? When you'd ask someone that, of course, most people when they go to clubs and bars, they go with friends or they go with partners. So if you select one person, the friends or partners say, I don't want to participate in your study, or I wasn't selected, and they go on inside. So people were more likely to decline participating in the study, whereas if you have a team of two and you can walk up to two people and say, hey, will you guys do a really quick survey? We found that people were more willing to say, sure, I'll do your really quick survey. That's fine. Now, in terms of what was going on with the heterosexual, particularly the heterosexual women, we found that substance use only really among heterosexual women and some among heterosexual men declined when we stopped screening at the individual level. So what was going on with that? We believe that when we were selecting people at random, I could pull you out, your friends go inside, they're nowhere around you anymore, so maybe you're more likely to say, yeah, sure, I've done drugs before, but if you're with your friends or with your partners, even though we separated you from each other, we're administering a survey in a public setting, are you afraid that your friends can hear what's going on? And maybe that's why substance use declined during the second time. But why only heterosexuals? Well, we believe that because a lot of research has suggested that drug use is more common among GLB populations, that it's possible that maybe there's more complacency around it. So people are like, who cares if my friends can hear what I'm saying? Because, you know, we're all doing drugs. I don't know. This is just ideas that we're throwing out here. We also, you know, spent 2 years recruiting with 223 different venues over the course of the project that were randomized, so maybe that has to be factored in as well into why things varied from time one to time two. So what are the sort of implications from this? And I haven't gone into this. It's, again, it's on the table if you want to look at it. A lot of participants were doing drugs in this study. 60-something percent across all groups had said, yeah, I've done drugs before or greater. The most popular drugs reported were MDMA and cocaine. So maybe that's something as researchers that we want to look at in the future. Using this method, this very brief intercept way, might be an effective way to detect, you know, drug users, maybe even binge drinking. So it questions the idea. Maybe can we develop an intervention in the field? What would that look like? I have no idea how you would, you know, administer an intervention to someone that's going into a club to do their drugs. But this says maybe, you know, this is a good arena to look into. Some researchers have said, can we train bartenders and, you know, other staff to recognize harmful behavior? But that's a different presentation. Is time-space sampling better than other methods? This study won't answer that. You know, we had a previous presentation on respondent-driven sampling. We only compared two versions of time-space sampling, so I can't say if it's better than RDS or convenience-based sampling or whatever else. And of course, our data are limited to people that were attending bars and clubs in New York City, a great population to study club drug use among, but that's our limitation there. So I'm happy to answer questions afterwards so we can yield to the next presenters. Thanks a lot.